Comrade 35, Jeffrey Deaver. Tuesday. To be summoned to the highest floor of GRU headquarters in Moscow made you immediately question your future. Several fates might await. One was that you had been identified as a counter-revolutionary or a lackey of the bourgeoisie imperialists, in which case your next address would likely be a gulag, which were still highly fashionable, even now in the early 1960s, despite First Secretary and Premier Khrushchev's enthusiastic denunciation of Comrade Stalin. Another possibility was that you had been identified as a double agent, a mole within the GRU, not proven to be one, mind you, simply suspected of being one. Your fate in that situation was far simpler and quicker than a transcontinental train ride. A bullet in the back of the head, a means of execution the GRU had originated as a preferred form of execution, though the rival KGB had co-opted and taken credit for the technique. With these troubling thoughts in mind and his army posture well in evidence, Major Mikhail Sergeyevich Kavarin strode toward the office toward which he'd been summoned. The tall man was broad-shouldered, columnar. He hulked rather than walked. The Glavno Razvedyevatelno Upravlenye was the spy wing of the Soviet armed forces. Nearly every senior GRU agent, including Kavarin, had fought the Nazis 1 meter at a time on the Western Front, where illness and cold and the enemy had quickly taken the weak and the indecisive. Only the most resilient had survived. Nothing culls like war. Kavarin walked with a slight limp, courtesy of a piece of shrapnel or a fragment of bullet in his thigh. An international gift from a German or an inadvertent one from a fellow soldier. He neither knew nor cared. The trek from his present office at the British desk downstairs was taking some time. GRU headquarters was massive, as befitted the largest spy organization in Russia and, rumors were, the world. Kavarin stepped into the anteoffice of his superior, nodded at the aide-de-camp who said the general would see him in a minute. He sat and lit a cigarette. He saw his reflection in a nearby glass-covered poster of Lenin. The Communist Party founder's lean appearance was in marked contrast to Kavarin's. He thought himself a bit squat of face, a bit jowly. The comrade major's thick black hair was another difference, in sharp contrast to Lenin's shiny pate. And while the communist revolutionary and first premier of the Soviet Union had a goatee that gave him, with those fierce eyes, a demonic appearance, Kavarin was clean-shaven and his eyes under drooping lids were the essence of calm. A deep pull on the cigarette. The taste was sour and he absently swatted away glowing flecks of cheap tobacco that catapulted from the end. He longed for better but couldn't spend the time to queue endlessly for the good Russian brands, and he couldn't afford the Western smokes on the black market. When the cigarette was half-smoked, he stubbed it out and wrapped the remainder in a handkerchief, then slipped that into his brown uniform jacket. He thought of the executions he'd witnessed and participated in, often a last cigarette for the prisoner. He wondered if he'd just had his. Of course, there was yet another fate that might await having been summoned to this lofty floor of headquarters. Perhaps he was being rewarded. The comrade general speaking for the chairman of the GRU or even the Presidium itself, the all-powerful Politburo, could be recognizing him for furthering the ideals of communism and the glory of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. In which case he would receive not a slug from a Makarov pistol, but a medal or commendation or perhaps a new rank, though not, of course, a raise in pay. Then, however, his busy mind, his spy's mind, came up with another negative possibility. The KGB had orchestrated a transgression to get him demoted or even ousted. The Soviet civilian spy outfit and the GRU hated each other. The KGB referred to their military counterparts contemptuously as boots because of the uniforms they wore in their official capacity. The GRU looked at the KGB as a group of effete elitists who trolled for turncoats among the Western intelligentsia, men who could quote Marx from their days at Harvard or Cambridge but who never lived up to their promise of delivering nuclear secrets or rocket fuel formulas. Since neither the KGB nor the GRU had exclusive jurisdiction in foreign countries, Poaching was common. On several occasions in the past year, Kavarin had run operations in England and the Balkans right under the nose of the KGB, and turned an agent or assassinated a traitor before the civilian spies even knew he was in country. Had the pricks from Lubyanka Square somehow put together a scandal to disgrace him? But then, just as he grew tired of speculation, the door before him opened and he was ushered into the office of the man who was about to bestow one of several fates. A train trip, a bullet, a medal, or another endearing possibility in the Soviet Union. Perhaps something wholly unexpected.
"You may smoke," said the general.
Kavarin withdrew a new cigarette and lit it, marshalling more escaping sparks.
"Thank you, sir."
"Comrade Major, we have a situation that has arisen. It needs immediate attention."
The general was fat, ruddy, and balding. The rumors were that once he had set down his rifle and chosen to strangle rather than shoot a Nazi who came at him with a bayonet on the outskirts of Berlin in 1945. One look at his hands and you could easily believe that.
"Yes, sir, whatever I might do."
So far, this did not seem like a death sentence.
"Did you know Comrade Major Rasnakov? Vladimir Rasnakov?"
"Yes, I heard he suffered a heart attack, died almost instantly."
"It should be a lesson to us all,"
the general pointed his cigarette at Kavarin.
"Take the baths, exercise, drink less vodka, eat less pork."
The man's rasping voice continued.
"Comrade Rasnakov was on a very sensitive, very important assignment. His demise has come at a particularly inconvenient time, Comrade Major. From reading your dossier, you seem like a perfect replacement for him. You can drive, correct?"
"Of course."
"You speak English fluently?"
"Yes."
This was growing more intriguing by the moment. The general fixed him with a fierce gaze of appraisal. Kavarin held the man's eyes easily.
"Now let me explain. Comrade Rasnakov had a job that was vital to the cause of communist supremacy. He was in charge of protecting the lives of certain people within the United States, people who we have deemed indispensable to our interests."
Because they were all trained soldiers, GRU agents often served as undercover bodyguards for valuable double agents in enemy countries.
"I will gladly take over his tasks, sir."
The vodka bottle thudded onto the middle of the desk. Glasses were poured and the men drank. Kavarin was moderate with alcohol, which put him in the minority of men in Russia. But just like not uttering certain thoughts aloud, you never declined the offer to share a drink with a superior officer. Besides, this was real vodka, good vodka, made from corn. Although as a soldier and a member of the GRU, Kavarin had some privileges. That meant simply potatoes without frostbite, meat once a week instead of every other, and vodka that, while it didn't poison you, came in a corked bottle with curious flecks afloat. Unlike the KGB, whose agents, even those in the field, had the best liquor and food and never had to queue. The general's voice diminished nearly to a whisper.
"Intelligence has received from a trusted source in America about a forthcoming occurrence there. It is necessary that the man behind this event remains alive, at least until he completes what he intends."
"Who is this person? An agent of ours? Or another service?"
The general stubbed out his cigarette and lit another. Kavarin noted he left a good inch and a half unsmoked. The ashtray was filled with such butts. Together they must have made up a full pack.
"No."
His voice was even softer now. And astonishing, the comrade generally actually seemed uneasy. He tapped the top secret file before him.
"As you'll see in here, this man, Comrade 35, the code name we've given him, is not motivated by any overt desire to help the Soviet Union, but that's exactly what the effect of his actions will be, if he succeeds in his mission."
The general's eyes were far more intense than his whispered voice as he said,
"And it is up to you to make sure that he remains alive to do so."
Of course.
Now, Comrade Rasnikov learned that there are two men who intend to take the life of our American comrade by week's end. That cannot happen. Now read this file, Comrade Major. Study it, but make sure it does not leave the building. It is for your eyes only. It is perhaps the most sensitive document you will ever come in contact with.
Of course.
Learn all you can about Comrade 35 and the two men who wish to harm him. Then make plans to leave immediately for America. You'll meet with Comrade Colonel Nikolai Spesky, one of our GRU agents in place. He can provide weapons and updated intelligence.
Thank you for the opportunity, Comrade General. Kavarin rose and saluted. The General saluted in return, then said,
One more thing, Comrade Major.
Yes, sir.
Here.
The man handed him a packet of French cigarettes.
You must learn to smoke something that will not set fire to the carpet of your superior officers.
Kavarin returned to his own small office, which offered a partial view of the airport. He would sometimes sit and look at airplanes on final approach. He found this relaxing. He opened the file and began to read. He got no more than halfway through the first paragraph, however, then sat up with a start, electrified as he read what the mission would entail and who was involved. Oh, my God! Kavarin lit a cigarette, one of the new ones, and noted that for the first time in years his thick fingers were actually shaking. But then, soldier that he was, he put aside his emotions at the momentous consequences of the assignment and got to work. Wednesday. The flights were carefully planned to arouse the fewest suspicions of the enemy intelligence services. For the trip, Kavarin was dressed Western, a black fedora, a fake bespoke suit, and white shirt and narrow black tie. Like a funeral director, he thought. Which in a macabre way seemed appropriate. His route took him from Moscow to Paris on an Aeroflot TU-124, then to Heathrow. He connected there to a Trans-Canada Airlines DC-8 bound for Montreal. Finally, he flew from Canada into the United States, first port of call, Idlewild Airport in New York City. 4 hours later, he disembarked in Miami. Whereas New York had seemed hard as steel, edged and unyielding, the Floridian metropolis was soft, pastel, soothed by balmy breeze. Kavarin walked from the airport terminal, inhaling deeply the fragrant air, and hailed a taxi. The car, a huge Mercury, bounded into the street. As they drove, Kavarin stared at the palm trees, the bougainvillea, and plants he'd never seen. He blinked to observe a flamingo in the front yard of a small bungalow. He'd seen the birds in Africa and believed they were water dwellers. He laughed when he realized the creature was a plastic decoration. He regretted that dusk was arriving quickly, and soon there was nothing to see but lights. In a half hour, he was at the address he sought, a small one-story office building, squatting in a sandy lot filled with unruly green ground cover. On the front window was a sign. East Coast Transportation Associates, Nick Spencer, proprietor. As good a cover as any for a spy operation, he reflected. After all, the company did do some transporting. Stolen secrets and occasional bodies. And the proprietor's pseudonym was a reasonable tinkering with the real name of the GRU agent who worked out of the facility. Kavarin found the door locked and knocked. A moment later, it flew open, and there stood a round, broad-shouldered man in a short-sleeved beige shirt with black vertical stripes of a chain design and powder-blue slacks. His shoes were white.
Ah, comrade!
Nikolai Spesky cried, warmly pumping his hand. Kavarin frowned at the word, looking around at the other office buildings nearby. Ushering him inside and locking the door behind them, Spesky laughed, and wrinkles rumpled in his tanned face.
What are you worried about, comrade? Microphones? It's a different world here.
I suppose I am.
No. See, here to eavesdrop, the government must get the courts to approve it.
Which they surely do.
Ah, comrade, not necessarily. You'd be surprised. And what's more, the CIA has no jurisdiction here.
Caverin shrugged. He took off his heavy jacket. The temperature was about 75 degrees.
Sit,
Spassky said jovially. The men lit cigarettes. Spassky seemed delighted Caverin was the agent chosen to take over for Comrade Rasnikov.
You are quite famous,
Spassky said, though without the awe that would have made his comment awkward.
The vile traitor Penkovsky. The people owe you quite a debt, comrade.
Penkovsky was a GRU agent who spied for the British and Americans, his most valued contribution being providing information that helped Kennedy stand up to the Russians during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. He was, as Caverin had learned, less motivated by ideology than by a desire to lead a decadent life in the West, which he had, until caught by the Soviets and executed.
I was merely one of a number of people who found the traitor.
Modest, modest. A good trait for a spy. We must remain unseen, anonymous, subtle. Only in that way can the exultant cause of Mother Russia and the ideology of Herrn Marx and Engels, as espoused by our noble progenitor Comrade Lenin, be furthered for the glory of our cause and the people.
Caverin remained silent at this pronouncement. But then, as if he could not control himself, Spassky exploded with laughter.
I do a very good impersonation of the Premier, do I not?
Khrushchev was notorious for his bombastic speeches, but Caverin wouldn't think of answering the question affirmatively, though Spassky was, in fact, spot on. The man scoffed good-naturedly.
Relax, relax, comrade. We are field agents. The rules don't apply to us.
His smile faded.
It's a dangerous job we do. And we are to be entitled to some indulgence, including poking fun at the people and the institutions taken far too seriously at home.
He patted his large belly. To Caverin it resounded like a timpani.
I missed my lunch today, comrade. I must eat something.
Squinting at his guest, the man asked,
Now, do you know of care packages?
Yes, indeed. They were a propaganda tool created by the West after the war for the purpose of exploiting the unfortunate and winning them to the cause of capitalism and imperialism.
Spassky waved his hand impatiently.
You must learn, Comrade Major, that in this country not every comment is an invitation to a political statement. I was merely inquiring if you know the concept, because I have received a care package of sorts from my wife in Moscow, and I have been waiting for your arrival to indulge.
He lifted onto his desk a large cardboard carton labeled Accounting Forms, and, with a locking blade knife, sliced open the lid. He removed a bottle of good vodka, Stolichnaya, and tins of pâté, smoked fish, and oysters. He unwrapped a loaf of dark bread and smelled it.
Not bad. Not too moldy yet.
They drank the vodka and ate the bread and pâté, both of which were excellent. The bread didn't taste the least moldy to Caverin, and he had quite some intimate knowledge of bread in its final stages. Tossing down a third small glass of vodka, Spassky said,
I will tell you the details of this assignment.
His face clouded over.
Now, our comrade 35, the man you are to protect, is not a particularly likable fellow.
So I have read.
He acts impulsively. He speaks out when he should listen. Frankly, I believe he is a cruel man and may be unstable. Accordingly, he has made enemies.
The comrade general told me that there are two men who present an immediate threat.
Yes, that's correct. They are U.S. citizens, though of Latin American extraction. Comrade Rasnikov learned that they plan to kill him sometime on Friday.
He slid a slim file across the battered desk.
Your job is to intercept them, then communicate with them.
Communicate?
Yes, exactly, with one of these.
Spassky removed two pistols from his desk, along with two boxes of ammunition.
You are familiar with these?
One was a Colt Woodsman, a small caliber .22, but very accurate, thanks to the long barrel. The other was a large 1911-style Colt .45.
And you will need a car, comrade.
Spassky told him.
I understand you can drive?
A nod.
Good. In the file you will find an address, an abandoned house. There's a garage behind it, off an alley. Garage, they say here to mean not a repair station, but a separate place to keep your car in, like a stable.
I'm aware of that.
In the garage is a Chevrolet Bel Air. The keys are hidden up under the front seat. Ah, I see you know not only guns, but automobiles too, comrade.
Spassky had apparently noticed that Kavarin was smiling at the mention of the Bel Air.
Now these are your targets.
Spassky opened the file and tapped the document. Kavarin read through the file carefully, noting facts about the two men whose mission was to kill Comrade 35, Luis Suarez and Carlos Barkin, both in their mid-30s. Dangerous men who were former prisoners. They had murdered before. Their round faces, both bisected with thick mustaches, looked sullen, and Barkin gave the impression of being stupid. Kavarin, though, knew it was a mistake to underestimate your enemy. He'd seen too many soldiers and agents die because they had done just that. So he read carefully, learning every fact he might about the men. According to Rasnikov's sources, the two were presently traveling whereabouts unknown, but would arrive in Texas day after tomorrow. The plan was to kill Comrade 35 that day. Spassky explained that Rasnikov had planned to lie in wait and kill them when they arrived at the boarding house. This would be Kavarin's job now. He pushed the file back and placed the guns and ammunition in his attaché case. Spassky then handed him an envelope. It contained $1,000 U.S. and another airline ticket.
Your flight's tomorrow morning. You'll stay at a hotel near the airport tonight.
After calling for a taxi, Spassky poured more vodka and they ate the rest of the pâté and some smoked oysters. Spassky asked about life back in Moscow and what were the latest developments at GRU headquarters. There was gossip about who had become non-persons and an affair at a very high level, though Kavarin was careful not to mention any names. Spassky was delighted nonetheless. Neither man, however, had any hesitation in sharing stories about the latest KGB cock-ups and scandals. When the taxi arrived, Spassky shook Kavarin's hand. Suddenly the brash spy seemed wistful, almost sad.
You will enjoy certain aspects of life here, comrade. The weather, the food, the plenty, the women, and, not the least, the absence of spies and informers dogging you everywhere. Yet you will also find such freedom comes at a price. You will be alone, much, and you will feel the consequences of that solitude in your soul. There is no one to look out for you, no one above to care for you. In the end, you will long to return home to Mother Russia. I know this for a fact, comrade. I have 8 months left here, and yet already I am counting the days until I can fly back to her bosom.
Thursday. The flight next morning on a propeller-driven DC-7 was turbulent as the plane fought its way west through strong winds. The journey was so bad that the stewardesses, who were quite beautiful, could not serve breakfast. Kavarin, more irritated at that fact than scared, at least had managed to secure a vodka, and he took comfort in sipping the drink and smoking nearly half a pack of Chesterfield cigarettes, which were marvelous, during the flight. The weather broke, and as they descended, he could look down and see flat, sandy earth for miles and miles. Grass bleached by the season, occasional groves of trees. Cattle. Lots of cattle. The aircraft landed uneventfully and the passengers disembarked. He took his attaché case, containing his guns and ammunition, from the plane's overhead bin and walked down the stairs onto the tarmac. Pausing and inhaling the petrol and exhaust-laced air, Mikhail Sergeyevich Kavarin found himself content. Here he was in a country very different from that portrayed by the great propaganda mill of the Soviet Empire. The people were friendly and courteous, the food and cigarettes plentiful and cheap, the workers content and comfortable, not the least oppressed by greedy capitalist robber barons. And the weather was far nicer than in Russia this time of year, and nearly everyone owned an automobile. Kavarin strode into the lobby of Love Field in Dallas, Texas. He glanced at the front page of today's morning newspaper, Thursday, November 21, 1963. Kennedy to visit Dallas tomorrow. President and First Lady join Governor for fundraiser at Dallas Trade Mart. Feeling the weight of the guns and ammunition in his case, Caverin now felt an unabashed sense of pride to think that he alone had been selected for this critical mission of helping the USSR extend its reach throughout the world and further the glorious goals of communism. As he waited for his bus at a weedy stop in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald was troubled. People had been following him. He knew this for a fact. People who wanted to do him harm. The skinny, dark-haired man in his mid-20s looked around him again. Was there someone watching him? Yes. But no, it was just a shadow. Still, he wished he had brought his pistol with him. He awakened early in his boarding house on Beckley Avenue in Oak Cliff and taken a bus to a stop near the Dobbs House restaurant for breakfast. The food had been bad, and he'd complained. He wondered why he kept going back there. Maybe I'm a creature of habit, he reflected. He'd heard the phrase on a TV show. Was it Ozzie and Harriet? He'd wondered. He liked that show, partly because it echoed his nickname in the Marines, Ozzie Rabbit. When he thought this, he remembered his days in the service and recalled the fight he'd gotten into with a sergeant, and that made him angry once more. As angry as he'd been with the waitress over the food. Why do I keep going back there? He thought again. Looked around once more. He didn't see any overt threats, but he still had to be careful, considering what he had planned for tomorrow. And considering that he knew people were after him, smart people, ruthless ones. The bus arrived, and Oswald boarded it and rode to the place he worked, the Texas Book Depository on Elm Street and North Houston, across from Dealey Plaza. He climbed off the bus and gazed about him once more, expecting to see one of the sullen faces of the men who he was sure were following him. FBI, maybe. Those bastards had been harassing Marina and their friends again. Oh, he'd made some enemies in his day. But in morning glare, it was a beautiful autumn day. He saw only housewives with perambulators and a few salesmen, a retired couple or two, ranchers, some Hispanic men. Killers? It was possible. Oswald grew alarmed and leapt into the shadows of the depository building to study them. But they showed no interest in him and strolled slowly to a landscaping truck, pulled out rakes, and headed into the park across the street. Despite the bristling of nerves up and down his back, Oswald noted that no one seemed to have much interest in him. He shivered again, though this was from the chill. He was wearing only a light jacket over his T-shirt, and he had a slight frame with little natural insulation. Inside the depository, he greeted fellow workers, nodding and smiling at some of them, and he got to work. It was while he was filling out paperwork for a book order that he happened to look down at a scar on his wrist. He was thinking of his attempt to become a Soviet citizen several years before. He was about to be deported but had intentionally cut himself to prolong his stay after his visa expired and convince the Russians to accept him. Which they had, and they welcomed him as a comrade. But there was a lot of important work to do in this hemisphere, and with his Russian wife, he'd returned to the United States where he'd resumed his pro-communist and anti-American activities. But now, he wanted to return to Russia, for good, with Marina and their two baby girls. There'd been a setback, though. An incident had occurred that had put his plans and his life at risk. After he finished his task tomorrow, he wanted to go to Cuba for a while and then get back to Russia. Just last month, he'd gone to the Cuban consulate in Mexico City to get a visa to allow him to travel to Havana, but the bastards had given him the runaround. The officials had looked over his records and said he wasn't welcome in Cuba. Go away. None of them understood what an important man he was, more important than his 5'9", 135-pound frame suggested. None of them understood his great plans. The rejection in Mexico City had sparked his terrible temper, and he'd said and done some things he shouldn't have. The Cuban security force had been called, and he'd fled the capital and eventually made his way back home. Stupid, he told himself, making a scene like that. Like fighting with the waitress at the diner. He'd lost control and made a spectacle of himself. Stupid! he raged aloud. He shivered once more, this time from pure fury, not fear or from the chill, and gazed out the window of the depository looking for people spying on him. Fucking Cubans. Well, start being smart now. He decided it wouldn't be safe to go back to the boarding house. Usually he spent weekdays at the boarding house. Tonight he'd return to the Paynes in Irving, stay the night. Considering what he was about to do tomorrow, he couldn't afford any complications at the moment. His serenity returned, thanks largely to a memory of his time in the Marines in 1954, specifically the day his firearms instructor had looked over his score on the rifle range and given him a nod. The man never smiled.
You did good, Hazzy. Those scores? You just earned yourself the rank of sharpshooter.
Anthony Barter swung his slim frame out of the car. He stretched. The 31-year-old was tempted to light a Winston, needed one bad, but his employer wouldn't approve. It wasn't like drinking, that was wholly forbidden, but even taking a fast drag could get you in hot water. So he refrained. An old Martin 404 roared overhead and skewed its way onto the runway at Love Field. He straightened his narrow tie and his dark gray felt fedora, from which he'd long ago removed the green feather. Very bad form, that. Barter looked around, oriented himself, and went to the Eastern Airlines luggage claim area. His long hands formed into fists, relaxed and contracted once more. He found a supervisor, a heavy-set, balding man, sweating despite the pleasantly cool temperature. He displayed his identification. The man drawled,
"Oh, well, FBI."
Barter was from New England. He'd been assigned to Texas, though, for 10 years and recognized an accent from much further south, probably El Paso. He explained he needed to find out about a passenger who'd arrived that morning from Miami. The supervisor almost seemed amused at the idea that luggage handlers could recognize a passenger, but he went off to gather his employees. The Bureau's New York field office had informed their colleagues in Dallas-Fort Worth that a man believed to be a Russian military intelligence agent had arrived in the country yesterday or today and continued on to Dallas. There had been debate in New York and Washington about the purpose of the agent's trip, if he was indeed an agent. There was, of course, the question of presidential security. Kennedy was coming to town tomorrow, and lately the threats against him had been numerous, thanks largely to the U.S.'s aiding Cuban rebels at the Bay of Pigs invasion, as well as Kennedy's and his brother's support for civil rights. He'd kicked some Soviet ass last year, too, of course, with the missile blockade, but no one in national security believed that the Ruskies were stupid enough to attempt to assassinate the president. No, more likely the spy's mission was pure espionage. The GRU was the intelligence organ specializing in stealing technology secrets, specifically those dealing with nuclear weapons and rocket systems, and Texas was home to a number of defense contractors. Barter's boss, the special agent in charge of the office here, immediately assigned him to the case. The only lead was a photograph of the purported spy entering the country as a Polish businessman. All individuals coming in from Warsaw Pact countries were surreptitiously photographed at customs at Idlewild Airport. The image was crude, but functional. It depicted a sullen man, blonde and large, wearing a fedora not unlike Barter's. The man was about 40 years of age. After viewing the picture of the Russian, however, the baggage handlers reported that they hadn't noticed anyone resembling him. Barter thanked them and stepped outside into the low November morning sun. Speaking to the cabbies was more productive. It took him only a half hour of canvassing to find the prompt-ride taxi driver who recognized the man in the photo. He'd taken him to a boarding house off Mockingbird. The man remembered the number. Barter climbed back into his red-and-white Ford Galaxy. He headed in the direction of the place and parked up the block. He approached cautiously but noted it was abandoned. Barter found a neighbor, a retiree, it seemed, who was washing his car. He showed his ID and asked about the house. After the typical blink of surprise at the credentials, the man said,
"Yes, sir, been closed up for months now. Bankruptcy. Foreclosed on. Damn banks. All respect."
Barter stifled a frown of frustration, fists clenching and relaxing.
Well, I'm trying to find someone who might have been here several hours ago.
He displayed the picture.
Yep, saw him. Got out a taxi cab. I was impressed. Them cost money. Taxis. Anyway, that fella picked up a car from the garage and drove off.
Car? Barter's heart beat a little faster, but the man had only heard the engine, not seen the make or model. They walked to the small, detached structure. Barter opened the unlocked door. The place was empty.
Sorry I can't be more help.
Barter sniffed the air and bent down to examine the floor of the garage.
You've been plenty helpful, sir. So was I right? Bank robber? He looked plumb like one. You have a good day, sir.
Mikhail Kaverin had checked into the Dallas Rose Motel, left his luggage, and was enjoying piloting the Chevrolet Bel Air through the spacious streets of Dallas. What a wonderful car this was. A Bel Air. How Kaverin loved cars. He'd always wanted one, though in truth not a Russian make. For one thing, you waited forever, and then you had to take whatever the government had on hand to sell you. For an exorbitant price. Where was communism when you needed it? And the best you could hope for was a temperamental, boxy AZLK, or the slightly more stylish and popular Gaz Volga, whose manufacturer's hopes for a handsome income stream by sales to the West never materialized, since the vehicle's sole decoration was a big red Soviet star. Guided by the map and instructions from a helpful service station attendant, Kaverin found the old East Dallas portion of town. The neighborhood was filled with private residences close together, many with front porches dotted with rockers and from whose roofs hung swings. He noted two inexpensive shops and a few small companies. He parked in front of the boarding house where Luis Suarez and Carlos Barquin would arrive tomorrow on their mission to track down and kill Comrade 35. It was a one-story, nondescript place just a notch above shabby. He carefully studied doors and windows and sidewalks. And which neighbors seemed to be home now during the day? Potential witnesses. He planned out the shootings. He would be waiting here in front of the house when they pulled up, with the trunk of the Bel Air open, pretending to be changing a tire. When they climbed out of their own car, he would shoot them and throw the bodies and their luggage in the trunk. He drove slowly up and down the street, scanning, scanning. A spy's primary weapon is the power of observation. His first handler at the GRU, a man who later became a non-person under Stalin, had insisted that Kaverin and he take long walks through the streets of Moscow. After they returned to headquarters, the mentor would interrogate the younger agent about what he'd noted. The initial trips yielded a half-dozen vague observations. The later ones, hundreds of impressions, all rendered in acute detail. Sergei had been pleased. Kaverin pictured the man's unsmiling yet kind face and could almost feel the affectionate arm on his young shoulders. Then he tucked the hard thought away. The peculiar circumstances of this assignment made Kaverin particularly cautious. He drove through the neighborhood again, looking for anyone who might be a threat. After 15 minutes, he was satisfied he had a good sense of the place and of the risks he might face. He piloted the expansive Chevy out of this part of town and onto the main road. In 10 minutes, he pulled into the parking lot of a large grocery store. As he climbed out and walked toward the front door, he thought, "This place has the most ridiculous name I've ever heard of in a retail establishment." The Russian spy was shopping in a Piggly Wiggly. FBI Special Agent Anthony Barter sat in his Galaxy, which was parked in the far end of the lot, and watched the spy walk toward the store. Picking up the spy's trail had been less daunting than he'd expected. He'd deduced by smell and an examination of the significant oil slick on the garage's floor that the spy was driving a car that leaked and burnt oil. So Barter had driven to the nearest gas station, a Conoco, and flashed a picture of the man. Sure enough, the attendant said that the man, who spoke English fine but with an accent, had come in driving a bright turquoise Chevy Bel Air, bought a couple quarts of Pennzoil. The Russian had also picked up a map of the area. He'd asked about the best way to get to Old East Dallas, then motored off in that direction in his oil guzzler.
Barter had headed over to that neighborhood himself and cruised the streets until he found the Bel Air, which was paused at a stoplight. It was hard to tell for certain, but he believed the driver was the man in the surveillance photograph. The FBI man almost smiled as he watched the spy stop in his tracks at the entrance of the grocery store, probably astonished by the multitude of plenty spreading out in the aisles. When he disappeared inside, Barter climbed out of his car and, hoping that the Russian would spend some time browsing the aisles, hurried to the Bel Air. The vehicle was registered to a company in Plano, which Barter suspected would be phony. The Russian's jacket and hat were sitting in the back seat. In the pocket of the sports coat, he found a key to room 103 of the Dallas Rose Motel on East Main Street in Grand Prairie, about 10 miles away. Barter returned quickly to his Galaxy and pulled out of the lot before the Russian left the store. He knew this was a gamble, but he was worried about continuing to follow his subject. J. Edgar Hoover had required all the agents in the Bureau to study communist spies. The message was that the GRU operatives were the best of the best. Barter was afraid he'd be spotted. So he left and drove to the parking lot of a gas station across the street from the Dallas Rose Motel. He waited nervously. What if the spy had checked out of the motel and simply forgotten to return the key? What if it wasn't even his jacket? Had Barter lost his only lead? If he ever needed a cigarette, it was now. But he managed to refrain, nervously clenching and unclenching his sweaty hands. 5 minutes passed. 10. Ah, thank you. The brashly colored Bel Air rocked into the driveway and pulled up in front of room 103. Barter's car was parked facing away from the motel, and he was hunkered down, observing through his rearview mirror. The Russian climbed out, looked around suspiciously, but not Barter's way. He lifted a large grocery sack from the floor of the passenger seat. He disappeared through the door of his room. Barter went to a payphone and called his office. He asked a fellow agent about the company to which the Bel Air was registered. The man called back 5 minutes later. Yes, it was fake. Barter then ordered a surveillance team put together. In 20 minutes, 4 FBI agents arrived in 2 cars, personal ones, as Barter instructed. 1 vehicle pulled in front and 1 in the rear of the motel. Whatever the Russians' game might be, it was now doomed to failure.